Hello and welcome to the That Word podcast. I'm your host, Madalina Jakob, co-managing editor of That Word North America. Today I am joined by two distinguished guests, Jamie Goldstein, co-chair of Paul Hastings Financial Restructuring Group, and Tyler Cohen, global head of restructuring and liability management at Lazard. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us. Really excited to be here today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Jamie is a standout expert in distress situations. He's known for his creative strategies and sharp negotiation skills, guiding hedge funds, private equity firms, asset managers, and companies through complex restructurings, including Chapter 11 cases, liability management deals, and distressed M&A across different industries. Tyler has over two decades of experience helping companies navigate their most pivotal moments. He's worked across industries on everything from restructuring and liability management to capital solutions and M&A. Along the way, he's helped raise billions in critical capital, deep loans, exit facilities, rescue financings, to keep businesses moving through complex transactions. Jamie, let's start with you. Talk us through your path, how you got here, how you've seen the restructuring landscape evolve over the years. Because I remember I first saw you in 2011, you spoke on a panel at a TMA conference, and then throughout the years, I documented your tremendous growth, first at Strook & Strook, and now at Paul Hastings.
Thank you, Madalina. You're right, we've known each other for quite a long time now. I grew up in Long Island. I went to a very large public high school, graduated from Brown and Cornell Law School. Started my career, I started at Skadden and then ultimately moved to a small boutique law firm doing debtor side work. Eventually, as you noted, I moved over to Strook, and pretty quickly after getting there, our group blew up. We went from about 30 lawyers to less than 10 in the group. And ultimately, I decided to stay with Chris Hansen and we regrew the group with the goal of being the top restructuring group in the planet, regardless of the size of our firm. We're very focused on creditor-focused mandates, and we ultimately formed the group under four core competencies: restructuring, finance, litigation, and M&A. And we thought that was pretty critical for handling everything that would ultimately deal with distressed investors' issues in some shape or form. The problem was we had no clients, so we gradually had to build a group. We started with asset managers and hedge funds dealing with convert issues and unsecured matters, and gradually went from 10 lawyers to 20 lawyers and 30, 50, eventually peak COVID, probably somewhere in the mid 50s. But it was a very different time, and we were very focused on Chapter 11s. It's obviously something we're going to talk about today. The world of bankruptcy and restructuring, as you note, has evolved. And as our group continued to grow, we started to do more work out of court. Around the time that our group, especially in the middle of COVID, started to peak in terms of size and revenue generation, we ultimately were contacted by someone that I'd met probably a decade prior to that, Frank Lopez. I met him at a charity event. He was a Proskauer at the time. Ultimately, he moved over to Paul Hastings. And within a few years of his arrival, he became the chairman of Paul Hastings. He reached out in the middle of COVID. I was not even leaving my house. I put on a mask. I left my house and met him for a cup of coffee. And he said that he became the chairman and he wanted to take our restructuring group if we were willing to move over our entire group, which was very exciting to me. We had thought about various moves. Chris and I, Chris Hansen, my co-chair of the Paul Hastings restructuring group, we were really focused on growing the group, growing the firm, Strook at the time, and potentially even looking to merge the firm. The firm doesn't exist today. It's since dissolved. But we were focused on being on the executive committee, how to grow our existing home, if you will. But I was very interested in the type of global platform that Paul Hastings would ultimately bring to our group. Eventually discussed with Chris, and it started about a 10-month process where we did a tremendous amount of work understanding what the move would entail and what being on a platform like that would mean to our group. Lo and behold, after many months, we moved in 22. I think it was March or April 22. Actually, April 1st. We took almost 50 lawyers, a little less, over to Paul Hastings. And we've now combined with the existing Paul Hastings group and then subsequent additions that we've had to form an approximately 120-lawyer group, which we're very excited about. We're very confident that it's one of the top, one of the largest, one of the top restructuring groups in the market today across the U.S. and Europe. And I am curious if Tyler agrees on this point, but what I've seen from a restructuring evolution standpoint is, as I noted, we used to deal with a lot of unsecured issues. And exactly. We've migrated up the top of the capital stack to the secured side. Pretty critically, we also used to be in court all the time. And now that's starting to come back. But for a number of years, that started to dissipate. And we were just doing a tremendous amount out of court. I think that, especially the way that our group is structured now and the firm's platform, which is so credit and finance focused, it lends itself to the current evolution of restructuring, which is out of court first, do everything you can to try to avoid the process and the expense associated with it. But now things are starting to go back into Chapter 11 for a variety of reasons, macro, micro, or company specific.
Exactly. Tyler, pivoting to you, our field, as Jamie mentioned, has changed dramatically since your involvement, let's say, in the restructuring of Energy Future Holdings. This was at that time, the bankruptcy was considered the largest buyout in U.S. history. So it was a big case almost over a decade ago. But fast forward to today, as Jamie pointed, liability management exercises, LMEs, have become the go-to tool to keep companies out of Chapter 11. Let's hear your thoughts. How have you seen restructurings evolve over the years?
Yeah, so for first and foremost, thanks for having us. So for a little context, I joined Lazard back in 2003. I was a generalist, not doing restructuring in the early days. I joined right out of undergrad at Northwestern, did a little bit of restructuring work in 2004, but didn't jump in full time until the financial crisis in late 2007, early 2008. And for me, when I started to get involved at that time, there was really only one product that we were selling, which was Chapter 11. And Lazard's platform was almost exclusively company-side focused at that point in time. And we wouldn't go out and market to companies. The old adage in our business on the debtor side was first advisor in the room gets punched in the face, the second one gets hired, because you don't want to tell somebody their baby's ugly. And so it was a tough business where we really relied on relationships, principally with law firms who were corporate counsel. They'd bring in the restructuring folks and you'd wait for the phone to ring and there'd be bake-offs. And as long as you got invited to enough pitches and you won half or one out of three, you had a great business. It was pretty straightforward. It wasn't really an intellectually capital-driven.
Almost like a numbers game,
right? Totally. It wasn't an intellectually capital-driven business. That all really started to change in the years after the financial crisis with the explosion of covenant-lite loans and bonds that created a lot more flexibility for companies to do adequate liability management. And we at Lazard were on the forefront of inventing a lot of the LME technology that we're using today, did one of the earliest kind of drop-down financings and exchanges for J.Crew, exploiting the J.Crew trapdoor. And that really set off a new trend, figuring out how companies and particularly sponsors can exploit the loopholes in documents to extend their runway and option value and grow back into their capital structure. And in the early days, in the 2016, 2017, 2018 timeframe, LMEs were few and far between. There was a lot of hesitancy amongst companies to, you know, be aggressive and go down that path. The reaction from the lender community, particularly CLOs, was incredibly adverse. They viewed it as very exploitive because at that time, many of the CLOs were not organized in a way that had a lot of the in-house restructuring capabilities to kind of work through these deals. And so we were seeing situations where, you know, CLOs would sell out, hedge funds would come in, hedge funds would take advantage of the CLOs in those early days. And so it was kind of an early version of lender on lender violence driven by some of the market constraints that existed.
Exactly. The CLOs cannot hold a lot of triple C paper.
So yeah, triple C paper or equity historically. Yeah. And that was in the earlier versions of some of their CLO documents. All of that really, I think, changed and accelerated during COVID when on the company side, there was this perspective that our backs are up against the wall. We have no choice but to do something. We're in this unprecedented environment where we just got to survive. And there was an openness of a lot of white shoe sponsors to just do whatever it takes to keep the lights on. And so we saw a big explosion of aggressive LMEs. And with that, the creditor community also evolved. They gained the skill set. They changed their documents. They put in place permanent workout restructuring people. And they had all those skill sets on site to play in this process and really flip from playing defense to playing offense. And so there's this big evolution where things were changing. And it frankly, that evolution was a good thing. It gave a lot more optionality to companies. It gave creditors an opportunity to get together to drive transactions to maximize value for themselves. Sometimes it was certainly lender on lender violence, big guys win, small guys lose. But over time, we've seen that further evolve to what Jamie was saying, where now out of court, LME is always the first choice.
Which makes sense, right? It's more flexible. It's private. likely less strain on the company. You're hopefully not affecting customers or vendors or employees. It's just so much more flexible.
It is, and it's cheaper. However, I do think there is this kind of trade-off where if you want to be intellectually honest, LME is not for everybody. A lot of these businesses have over-levered capital structures that just fundamentally need to delever. And unless and until they delever, the lifeblood of those businesses is going to be squeezed out of it.
You're saying they should just pull the trigger and file rather than extend the run.
Exactly. Because the risk is most LMEs fail at the end of the day. There needs to be a restructuring. And for an increasing number of these LME transactions that we've done, the business is actually on life support by the time it gets to the second step, restructuring. And it raises the question of, okay, is this really a one-size-fits-all approach, or should we all be a little bit more deliberate in doing the hard thing, the big R restructuring earlier?
You talked about relationships. And so given the relationship-driven nature of our field and the fact that restructuring is very much a business built on trust, what does the toolkit for success look like today, especially in a market where, as you mentioned, there's a handful of firms dominating the CLO and lender group formation? What does it take to really break in and gain real market share?
You know, this is an interesting topic because it's one that Tyler and I in particular, it's why I'm excited to do this with him today, we've talked a lot about over the years. As I was mentioning before, our group has been around for a long time. And initially, we used to specialize in ad hoc work. When Chris Hansen and I started to devise how the group would ultimately be constructed, our goal was to work on asset manager, ad hoc group work, some finance work here and there, as much corporate work as we could find, maybe a litigation. Eventually, we'd want to break into the company side, debtor world, the official committee world. And we knew that the advent of CLOs was upon us starting, let's call it, 7, 8, 9 years ago. And back when we started, it was banks and asset managers. There were BDCs, but they were less active. CLOs were less active. There were no SPACs. It was just a different type of restructuring market. And so as we started to hear more about CLOs getting involved in financing or getting involved in transactions and ultimately dealing with defaults and workouts and everything that Tyler just described being more frequent, we started to realize how critical CLOs would be in our marketplace. And so we knew that we wanted to get in front of CLOs. We weren't exactly sure how. There were a couple of firms, law firms, that got a bit of a head start, frankly, to us in terms of trying to get in front of those institutions. And again, I remember talking to Tyler about, you know, trying to break into it as saying something that we wanted to do. It's something that he was looking to do as he was making the transition from more focused debtor to a little bit more of a debtor creditor mix. And he'll talk about that himself. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but it was very important to us to try to find a way into that market. And it's very clubby. And they're looking for institutions that understand their needs, that they trust, that are creative, that have a tremendous amount of finance expertise. And there really probably isn't room for 10 or 12 or 15 institutions to represent them on the, at least on the legal advisory side. There's probably 5 or 6 of us that all compete for market share. And it's taken a lot of time and it's quite competitive, which means you need to get in front of these institutions frequently. You need to try to find situations and present it to them early. And something we're going to talk about on this podcast, situations form earlier and earlier. The current joke is ad hocs are forming and co-ops are being signed when something's trading at par. That's hopefully not true.
But 99, sir.
My gosh. But it's there's reason it's a joke and it's becoming part of the conversation. So situations form earlier and our ability to gain confidence with that CLO community is something we're quite proud of. It's taken many years and we think that we've done a lot of good work both in transactions, LMEs, credit analysis, and a variety of situations.
I think the relationship nature of the business is also has been a big positive in the sense that today it's all about how do I get a deal done? And I grew up as a debtor-only advisor, and my mentor, David Kurtz, who ran our group for a long time, who I think, go to my deathbed believing is the best restructuring banker that ever walked the face of the earth. For him, the way I was raised, it was really an us versus them. It was a competition of how I squeeze creditors and get what I want. And it was very much kind of this zero-sum game mentality. And as I matured as a banker and as I started to become more senior and ultimately take over our global practice, my perspective has completely evolved where now it's all about how do I get to a deal? How do I create a win-win or as much of a win-win as possible for company and creditors? And the foundation for that is relationships. And so if you have a practice now where you have relationships on both sides, company, sponsor, as well as the creditor community, it opens up lanes for dialogue to talk about issues. What do people care about? How do you solve problems? And so I very much enjoy the business a lot more today than I did 10 years ago, because for me, I'm sitting in the middle trying to get to consensus. My only objective is to get to consensus. It's not about winning anymore. It's about just getting to a deal. And I believe these conversations and relationships are the key to being able to do that, to cut through a lot of the posturing that historically existed between advisors going right to the principals as a means of finding a solution. To Jamie's point, you don't build these relationships overnight. It takes years, years of a lot of investment in these relationships. It starts with really being able to demonstrate intellectual capital and unique insight into situations, bringing something that these folks really value and appreciate. That's certainly one component of it. But over time, that relationship morphs you to more of a personal one. You become kind of work friends or even maybe personal friends with these individuals. You see them in a social context outside of work. And that's really where the kind of the real trust is developed. And the model, particularly working on the creditor side or with sponsors, is there's an opportunity for repeat business. This isn't a one and done type thing. And that's a very attractive business proposition if you think about it. Historically at Lazard, we worked with companies, we take them through a restructuring, and we never see them again. Now we work with creditors. We have an opportunity, once the creditors take over ownership, to advise them on M&A and financings once they take over the company. And then there's always the next portfolio problem for one of these creditors, their next issue, where you get a chance to work for them again. And so it has this life cycle to it that is incredibly lucrative if you continue to deliver a high degree of service and insight into these situations.
Those are great points. The relationships that we have with our clients, I've always taken it for granted because I've only known restructuring. But I do feel, especially when I talk to some of my colleagues at other firms or even some of my partners in other groups at Paul Hastings, I think what we have in restructuring is quite special. The ability to have these very close relationships with your clients where you do get to see them personally, you get to go to events with them, boondoggles, you sometimes travel with them. You develop these long-lasting relationships that lead to continuity because there are going to be repeated deals. And another thing that we're excited about at Paul Hastings, and I think that Tyler would agree, is it's a fairly young field too. And we have hopefully a long runway ahead of us, the two of us and our teams, and we can develop continuity that's going to continue for a while. Another thing that Tyler said, I just want to touch on, the relationship across the professionals is absolutely critical. So the relationships you have with sponsors, very important, relationships with the clients, institutions, of course, but the relationships across professionals helps to get deals done.
Including our most ardent competitors who we're also friends with.
Correct. And it's having those very good relationships, being fair, treating people with respect on the other side, even when you don't see eye to eye on a matter or in a situation, pays dividends down the line. That's very important to us. And it's another reason, again, that I'm really happy to do this with Tyler today, because the two of us and our teams, obviously, we're aided by tremendous institutions and really deep benches behind us. But in many respects, we've created the CLO practices that we have at our institutions by sheer will. I remember standing on a beach many years ago, talking to Tyler when he said, I want to create this practice. And it was, in many respects, creating it from scratch. And I said, okay, I think I can help you, because I had to do the same thing a few years ago. And it's incredibly gratifying, especially Tyler stepped into a group, but he's grown it, obviously, to very significant heights. Chris Hansen and I have grown a group essentially from scratch to what we have today. So I really respect that. And I'm very proud of what I've accomplished. And I'm really impressed by what Tyler's done with his team.
Appreciate it. Yeah.
It sounds amazing how much work you need to put into, as you said, it's so important, the networking, not just being able to read documents and be an extremely smart lawyer, but also have these relationships.
They're looking for you to be creative. They're looking for you to be responsive and hardworking, and they're looking for you to sweat every single detail 25/8, as we like to say, and not mess up.
And deals are very important because we, like, having this view, I like how Tyler said that he looks at the relationship or he looks at a transaction as having an end game. The end game is a deal. It's not really a zero-sum game, because we've seen around recently, and we'll talk about it, what happened with Altice USA when a deal was not reached and you get into litigation and other issues. And I like, Jamie, you mentioned how that joke about lender groups forming really early when something trades at 99. But sometimes I feel like they do that because you have some sponsors who have a reputation for some aggressive LMEs. They are known to use some tactics to kick the can down the road. So we've seen this year a lot of LMEs that worked, that we're talking about this unprecedented Altice France deal that Tyler worked on it. But we've also seen companies that executed LMEs in the past and now they came back to the market. We're talking about United Size Services or Packer Sanitation or STG Logistics and others. These companies have already completed or are in right now are heading into out-of-court or in-court restructurings. So what is your read on LMEs this year, I might ask you, and what do you think we should expect going into 2026?
I'll kick it off. We still see a tremendous amount of activity going into 26. It has been really a landmark year for us across the group on the official committee side, on the CLO side, ad hoc side, company side. Really, everything's hitting, which we're really excited about. But as it relates to LMEs, certainly 25 had the highest number of LMEs in our group that we ever have before. And I see, based on what we're working on and what is in early inception, a tremendous amount being considered for 26. And that's an important point because Tyler mentioned it before. My finance partner, David Hong, and I recently did a webinar. We talked about what happens when you've been LME'd. What is step two? What does step two mean? And it's really interesting because in many situations that we've been involved in, we do the best we can to tighten documents. And that's critical. Our lenders want that. And they ultimately trade that, whether it's for maturity extension or discount or new money or a combination of all three. But they're going to get liquidity from a deal away if they choose to do that. But from incumbent lenders, you're looking at discount, maturity, and you're looking at potential new money. So to get that, you exchange as a sponsor or company document tightening. We take that very seriously. And perhaps we've done too good of a job in certain situations because, including in one that I'm working on with Tyler and his team right now, there was just not an ability for the company to ultimately take on another LME. There's no capacity left. Whether the consent thresholds are too high, you can't get an amendment done, or there's just not enough capacity, you're stuck. And so I think in 26, you're going to see more Chapter 11s. You're going to see more changes of control.
Chapter 11s from the first LMEs going into a Chapter 11, I would say, or?
Correct. I think you're going to see more in-court processes, potentially direct, but more likely step two Chapter 11s because you can't get another LME done. And so I think you're going to see more in-court and you're going to see just more willingness of lenders, especially on the CLO side and general parties on the broadly syndicated loan network willing to take the keys in ways that they haven't in the past. And we're seeing that in the second half of 25, and I think we're going to continue to see that in 26. It's just whether it was set up that way or whether it's just a willing, necessary step in the process, we're going to see that.
I agree completely and certainly would reiterate the point around a number of LMEs that we did in late in 24 or early 25 that we're going to see second step restructurings in most circumstances around. Just a lot of these are not working with rates still pretty high and tariffs and all this just kind of noise in the market creating challenges. We're also seeing a lot of non-sponsor private company activity as well and a big pickup in Chapter 11s associated with that. So that's like the First Brands, Pinegate Renewables. We've got a few more in the pipe that will be in bankruptcy within the next couple of months. I continue to believe that, as I said earlier, LMEs generally as a matter fail. They're just, it's too little too late, but there are definitely ongoing kind of structural impediments to encourage people to actually fix the balance sheet. Earlier, CLOs want to defer when they take equity, just given the way their docs are set up, and sponsors want to kick the can on taking the pain for as long as possible, particularly if they're in fundraising mode. And so while I would hope that if you're a rational kind of actor, you'd be more inclined to pursue a permanent fix that fairly allocates value amongst the stakeholders, like an Altice France transaction, the reality is the market is not set up to really adopt that approach in most circumstances when it's sponsor and the CLO-led lender universe. So while I could be hopeful, I'm not optimistic.
What's interesting with the concept of success is because you often hear that step one LME is not successful, but I guess we could debate that because from the sponsor perspective, they got more time. They were willing to ultimately enter into this transaction to kick the can down the road for everybody's benefit. The lenders, at least majority lenders, you could argue step one wasn't successful for them either because you need to do it again, but perhaps it was because you tighten a document and you set yourself up to either take control if you needed to, but ultimately design what step two would be, whether it's in court or out of court. So arguably, the first step is successful even if it doesn't work for a variety of reasons.
See, I would argue that success should be defined as maximizing value of the enterprise. And if you have an opportunity to do a transaction, let's say in 2024, and you choose an LME and you ultimately file and restructure in 2026, the question is, if you had done the real restructuring in 2024. Is the business worth more in 2026 by doing the big fix then or by doing it in 2026? And if you have a capital structure that is truly constraining a business, not allowing you to attract management talent, invest in the business to grow, you're going to be constraining the value of that enterprise. And so from my perspective, if people were truly, I would say, I don't want to say rational, because that's not the right word, because people operate within the constraints that they have given their situation. But if people were purely focused on maximization of value, you would see true deleveraging earlier on and an allocation of the upside amongst the different stakeholders. So maybe the sponsor gives up 80% or 90% control, but they have something, because in most circumstances, if they do the LME and it fails, they have zero.
You're representing companies, you should tell them that, but a lot of times sponsors don't want that. If they have an option to extend, they will always extend.
And people also are inherently optimistic. And so the grass is always greener tomorrow, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z, and they're not realistic about the constraints and challenges that they're really facing. But I've been singing this theme from the mountaintop for a long time, but nobody seems to listen. But I understand it's a bit of a differentiated perspective.
But I guess if we were to tie this all together, and we're going to probably talk about this in a little while, knowing that private credit is still an issue that everybody's interested in, whether we're dealing with private credit lenders or we're dealing with CLOs, there seems to be a land shift as far as everybody's willingness to either one, potentially go through a process, or two, to take the keys and or put in new money to accomplish that. It just seems to be a much more traditional style within the new participants.
And you talked about documentations being the tightening. Can you just tell us, how do you think that some of the terms, I'm talking about transfer restrictions, the majority threshold or sacred rights, how have they been redrafted as a result of LME litigation, CERTA, and just in general?
So without boring everybody getting into the details of CERTA or INCORA, I think, and at a very high level, CERTA obviously dealt with the ability on a non-pro rata basis to say that an open market purchase would potentially be valid. And if it doesn't get market tested or doesn't go through an established secondary market, would that open market purchase be considered valid? INCORA was a little different. A majority group was ultimately able to, in a two-step transaction, get around what otherwise would have been a two-third sacred right or consent threshold. If you look at both of these cases and what you take from it, it means that documents need to be A, as clear as possible, and B, as tight as possible. And the letters, the words on the page, and the four corners of your agreement absolutely matter. So what we're seeing now is the tightest documents that we possibly can get, from whether we're dealing with a step two transaction or dealing with original issuance, notwithstanding the fact that previously the private credit markets were so frothy, you were getting very loose documentation over the past couple of years. I think today, especially post all the litigation that's come together, we are seeing very significantly tight documents, as clear as you can possibly make it. It doesn't mean that there aren't going to be ways to ultimately accomplish a transaction in LME, because you have creative lawyers and creative sponsors and institutions that are doing everything they can to try to find loopholes. That's what they do. That's why they exist. But the clearer you can make your documents, the better from a potential risk perspective.
Now let's move on to a really hot topic, cooperation agreements. You mentioned them before, but basically these are, for our listeners who don't know what they are deals among creditors to stick together and speak with one voice when a company or sponsor tries to exploit loopholes in the credit agreements to do an LME, what we just talked about. They come in all shapes and sizes, some are pro rata, some are less inclusive. Adeptware even has a tracker of them, and they're becoming pretty standard in the market. Well, we have a recent lawsuit just before Thanksgiving. Altice USA has filed a lawsuit against the co-op group of creditors. We talk about Apollo, PGIM, JPM Investments. So there's a lot of debate in the market right now. Do you see co-ops, given this debate, as a necessary tool for creditors to protect themselves against these aggressive sponsors? Or do you think they risk hindering liability management exercises?
I think from the perspective of creditors, co-ops are absolutely a necessary and a critical tool, and frankly, a very effective one. And so I don't see the practice of entering into co-ops changing anytime soon, even in the face of potential antitrust litigations. There's been a lot of speculation, I would say, in our business over the last few years about, is this an antitrust violation or not? And We'll see how this plays out over the next couple of years in the courts, but I don't think it's going to change anything really in the interim. The one thing I would say, however, about co-ops is, in my mind, there is not a one-size-fits-all approach with these. They really need to be structured and customized for the situation at hand. And I think the one thing that our industry is doing too much of is entering into co-ops too early before people really understand what the potential pathway to a transaction is. And so increasingly, we are finding situations where the co-op, by its very nature, is hindering the ability to actually get to a deal. And it may be because of limitations on kind of fees or whatnot for the majority within a co-op. But I've been involved in a couple situations over the last few months where we're letting co-ops expire so that we can then enter into new ones that give a little bit more structural flexibility to get to a deal with a company. And so we need to find a little bit of balance where the first move is just not to co-op up. There needs to actually be a little bit of strategy at work to figure out what's the right form of co-op, what are the limitations, what do we want to let happen, what flexibility we want to give the majority so it doesn't get in the way of a deal at the end of the day.
It seems like at some point during this podcast, Tyler took off his creditor hat and put on his debtor hat.
He had the creditor hat in the beginning.
Actually, I was saying that from the perspective of creditors. Like, I had only, yes, because I think what I would say is I think the co-ops, like in Altice France, actually helped us get to a deal at the end of the day because we were negotiating with a critical mass. So I'm actually in situations now as a creditor advisor where the co-op is getting in the way because the co-op itself is too restrictive in terms of who gets what. And so there's no pathway to get to a deal that works for the majority with those limitations.
What Tyler's illustrating, and I think this is one of the subjects, I'm not going to comment on the litigation at the moment, but what I will say is it's the cooperation agreement in that situation was a bit unique in that it was a cross-class co-op.
Yeah, multiple classes. That was part of the problem. Effectively, they've created this massive intercreditor negotiating problem where there's no leverage within that group to keep people honest. And so you just
locked in certain parties, locked in the company sponsor, and just locked the situation up in a way that is a little different than many of the co-ops, or at least arguably did that, is a little different than many of the co-ops that we see today and many of the co-ops that we put together, which generally deal with one class and provide many significant benefits and, in fact, are continuing to be executed extremely early. And we see them in almost every situation. And by and large, they are very beneficial to the process and to the creditor groups. There are going to be situations where parties are not going to want to sign co-ops because they're just not sure which dance party they want to ultimately commit to, or they don't want to potentially upset the sponsor, or they do feel that there are certain things they want to accomplish as an individual institution or with another institution rather than working with a collective whole. But in our experience and what I've seen over the past, let's call it 4 to 5 years, the benefits to lenders into a company are significant from a co-op. They provide, from a lender perspective, they provide a group that trusts each other. They provide confidence that individual lenders aren't going to act untowards to each other and do something that will frustrate their collective purpose or do something that will harm the other institution. From a company's perspective, it allows confidence that they will get a deal done, that they have the requisite thresholds to move forward. And there's just an absolute benefit, it seems like, in almost every one of the co-ops that we put together. Obviously, there are exceptions, as Tyler spoke about, but we are seeing evolutions of the co-op over the past few years because, again, they're being executed significantly earlier than they ever have. I think in the past, they probably were more defensive, and now they're more offensive. They're more formal now. We like to call co-ops essentially bylaws. An official committee, official unsecured creditors committee, they have bylaws that govern how they operate, confidentiality issues, how they can maneuver within a Chapter 11 case, and how they meet, things of that nature. And while that doesn't typically happen with an ad hoc group, co-ops are creating rules and governing relationships, how you can trade, confidentiality issues, of course, and joiner requirements. But also they're creating, and we'll talk about this, I'm sure, carve-out premiums. They're just creating a formal relationship across the institutions that are akin to a contract, of course, because it is one. And so that formality is a big change from what we used to have from the typical informal ad hoc world. And so I should also just note, they're also longer. They used to just be a couple of weeks or a month, and then you could have a drag mechanism where it would go month to month. Now,
no, it was like 18 months co-ops.
I mean, the first one that we did, which was a co-op for life, was a 4-year co-op in Travelport, which maybe we'll talk about at some point. That was the first time that we'd ever done it. And it took a while to put it together, but it was critical. And we can explain that.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you actually if you can share an example, and Tyler spoke about this, from your experience where a co-op helped a deal get done or it actually slowed things down.
Yeah, so I think some of the most effective co-ops, like large scale ones, I would say Carvana is a good example. I think Dish DBS is a great example. While there hasn't been a quote unquote deal, it forced EchoStar to go monetize a bunch of assets, which we're going to accrue to the benefit. Exactly. So that's going to be an incredibly favorable outcome at the end of the day for DBS bondholders. I think Altice France, we had two different co-op groups, secureds and holdco unsecureds, having two groups that were the critical mass of both boxes that you could play off each other a little bit was the necessary kind of tool to keep people honest and ultimately get to a holistic transaction. Jamie said it, I think USA is a little bit different, and that one is so onerous that I think it's actually taken away the opportunity to get to a transaction. And
because of the multiple classes of creditors.
Yeah, and there are a few that I'm working on now that I don't want to speak to specifically, but where we're letting co-ops expire and entering into new ones to give more flexibility, because the math just doesn't work for the majority with the restrictions around pro rata economics. And we're having to redo some of them in order to find a pathway to get to a potential transaction with a company.
I will just touch quickly on Travelport again, because that was the first time that we had ever created a document that would last as long as it did. And it seemed wild at the time to ultimately lock lenders up to each other for what would be 5 years. And they were very worried that it would chill trading. They were very worried that it would impair liquidity, because obviously you have to trade your loans with a joiner requirement that would ultimately keep you locked up to the cooperation agreement. But it actually created a co-op bump. So not only was it meaning the price went up and it was very significantly lucrative to the individual lenders. So that was great for the lenders. And from a general process perspective, it prevented the company and the sponsors from ultimately trying to pick lenders apart and get to a majority and maneuver around them. And that led, that stasis, if you will, led to a deal, an ultimate consensual transaction where over $2 billion was eliminated and $600 million of new equity was put in by junior capital providers and the sponsors.
And you talked before about carve-out premiums. I feel like co-ops sometimes do create a power struggle between minority and majority groups, right? I'm just curious what you think about that.
Yeah, it's actually one of the hottest topics in co-ops that we see right now. When you have a group form, they come together, SteerCo, and let's call it the in-group, if you will, whether they come together on their own or whether they come together at the request of a sponsor, they're together and they're likely over a majority. And that group is going to design, they're going to be in the kitchen, if you will, they're going to be designing the transaction, they're going to be working through economics and the structures with the lawyers and the bankers to figure out how to ultimately help the company and the sponsor. The sponsor often wants a higher threshold signed up to the co-op. So they'll say, lawyers, ad hoc group, SteerCo, figure it out, get more people to sign up. So thankfully, what we've seen is groups, SteerCos are willing to, in many respects, share the economics. It's part of what we're dealing with today in a very positive way. We're seeing more inclusion. We're seeing more cooperation, more collaboration. It's a way to deal with some of these litigations that we're talking about to try to prevent them, to try to remove holdout issues. You either try to, if you need to, you buy out holdout positions, but more frequently, especially in light of situations like Converge One and litigations like that, where excluded institutions are going to litigate or potentially have the right to litigate and additional tools in their own toolbox, including parties in layer cake transactions and including them in cooperation agreements are pretty significant. And so you see lenders say, I'm not going to get the carve-out premium, why should I sign? The answer is usually transactions, especially today, are created where there are various layers and levels and discounts and they may go down. But if you're not part of the co-op, you will receive a very significantly reduced economic result as compared to being part of the cooperation agreement, even if you don't get that carve-out premium. So it's important to be part of the document, even if you're not part of this SteerCo.
And I mean, I know Tyler mentioned Altice France, because we're dealing with Altice USA here with a lawsuit, but it was interesting to see that we worked on this unprecedented cross-border restructuring. It was widely successful. We can even call it the deal of the year, I would say, because we've seen an LME across Europe and US that was successful. And now we're talking about an M&A, these friends being, so it's an M&A target. So we go from a potential restructuring to a win-win situation for everyone. It's a great situation because you had here a cross-border co-op with creditors from Europe and USA holding, I think, over $23 billion of debt. So a huge amount of debt. And you had players that are with different incentives. I think you had PIMCO Elliott, right? You had a more conservative PIMCO investor, and then you had Elliott, who we all know they're so aggressive and they have all this distressed history. So this happened while the sponsor was very aggressive as well. Patrick Drahi already moved the fiber assets away from the creditors. So the lenders needed that co-op to protect themselves.
Yeah, so the co-op was super successful, I think, in driving people to negotiate. And then I think we got a little bit lucky with kind of some of the market backdrop and situational dynamics that were in play that created the incentive for everyone to ultimately get to a deal. So what do I mean by that? You have a large telecom company. I think there was a perspective, particularly amongst the company, that there was real value in breaking up this enterprise, that creditors, as a general matter, undervalued the business and didn't see the value that Patrick saw. And given some of the changes in the M&A environment, particularly in France, as well as some of the political instability that existed in France, it created an opportunity, perhaps once in a lifetime, to go from a four-player market on the mobile side to a three-player market. And so there was a lot of optimism around, you know, potential M&A upside. And so there was a willingness, and I think rightfully so, of the sponsor, in this case, Patrick Drahi, to say, look, I'd rather own 55% of a massively delevered business that lets me play for the upside in selling the company in pieces than fighting this to the end of the earth with my creditors doing the aggressive drop-down transactions and taking out assets and doing all of that stuff, which could work at the end of the day, but it might not. And so there were these incentives to get to a deal. And it was a hard-fought negotiation. Lots of meetings, lots of yellings, lots of screaming. But at the end of the day, we were able to cut through it and pull out three members of a large 17-person steering committee and negotiate a deal on a principles-to-principles basis over a matter of 3 weeks and then take it back to everyone else and get it across the finish line. And it was hard. It was painful. But at the end of the day, I think it was the right answer for everyone. I absolutely believe that with a little bit of time and the right M&A transaction, there's a pathway for secured creditors actually to get a par plus recovery and an opportunity for folks that were invested very heavily in the holdco and secureds to get a material increase in value relative to what they purchased that debt at, as well as put billions of dollars in Drahi's pocket. So a great transaction all around. But I don't think it would have happened if there weren't co-ops, if we didn't have a critical mass kind of at the table with those incentives set up to force everybody to get to a deal.
And looking now ahead to 2026, do you think we'll see more co-ops forming, or do you expect the language and structure of this agreement to change in response to the Altice USA lawsuit?
I think we're going to see just as many, if not more, co-ops going forward.
Despite the lawsuit.
I think that the one thing that people will need to be mindful of is what the co-ops say with respect to actions the sponsors can or can't take and how much flexibility and maneuverability the company and the sponsors have to try to get a transaction done. That's where I think things start to maybe cross the line a bit more, but we continue to see co-ops executed literally this week, and that's going to go into 26.
For sure.
We need to write a story about that. So let's move to a different topic before we wrap up. Private credit restructurings, because I know, Jamie, you worked on a lot of those, and they've been picking up this year, as Tyler also mentioned. Can you share with us your perspective on this topic, and what is your outlook for 2026? Do you expect more private credit lenders to take the keys of these companies that are under stress?
I do. You know, we're very fortunate. At Paul Hastings, we have a very significant finance group, so we're doing a ton of private credit work from on the regular way side and on the designation original issuance work that sometimes goes the other way. So we're seeing all angles of the private credit world right now. And as I mentioned before, the private credit landscape has been so active that you initially were seeing very loose documents. But as the world has evolved and the restructuring landscape has evolved, you're seeing tighter documentation in private credit, the private credit world, and you're seeing private credit workouts. You're seeing sponsors more willing to take actions, probably starting with what happened concerning Vista and Pluralsight, and other situations going forward, and ones that we're going to continue to see, sponsors willing to take actions that frustrate the purpose and intentions and expectations of their private credit lenders. And I think historically, private credit lenders have been very loath to upset their sponsor relationships, to get in the way of them because they're worried about future deal flow and work going forward. But now private credit lenders are willing to do what they need to do for their own investment purposes and for their own LPs and their own ICs. And we're seeing much more aggressive relationships between lenders and sponsors. And I think we're going to start seeing more changes of control. We're going to start to see more fighting, potentially litigations and documents, as I said, that were looser that now probably require 100% consent for lenders to move. It's going to be an interesting scenario to see how those consortiums work together as ad hoc groups. Historically, as I mentioned, we were dealing with asset managers and hedge funds and banks and groups, and now we're dealing with CLOs, and now we're dealing with, after that, and now we're dealing with private credit lenders in ad hoc groups, and to an extent, they have not dealt with that before. So there's a little bit of education involved, and there's also a desire for there to be peace, but sometimes it's not going to work because different institutions may have different sensitivities.
So can you, maybe both of you, let us know what sectors, specific sectors, either in private credit and also in the BSL market, would be more active in 2026? What do you expect? I mean, in this year, from our perspective here at DebtWire, we've seen a lot of restructurings in the chemical, retail, and freight transportation sectors. I'm just curious, looking ahead, where do you expect the most restructuring activity? How do you see the overall pipeline shaping up?
I think it's a lot of more of the same, frankly. We're involved in a bunch of chemical, healthcare services, retail, renewables, legacy kind of tech. And then we're starting to see some episodic situations where kind of AI type risk is starting to create opportunities, not necessarily for Chapter 11s, more so for LMEs. But those are the kind of key themes I think we're focused on right now. It's pretty broad, frankly. And certainly on the Chapter 11 side, we're seeing more, as I said earlier, private non-sponsor Chapter 11 situations that just literally come out of nowhere. They're names that are not on our distress watch list. We've never heard of them before. They may not even have private credit or syndicated facilities. It may all be bank debt, but there's some huge capital structures out there that are starting to feel the pain, just given all the noise that exists.
What sector, if I may ask you, do you see this ink?
We're doing one that's, I'll say, broadly in the kind of consumer retail space company I've ever heard of. Not private credit, no. Like, we're talking like $1.5 billion, $2 billion of debt, but it's all bank debt.
Got it.
Yeah, from my perspective, I think I agree with what Tyler said, and I think we're going to continue to see healthcare. We're going to continue to see consumer spending, discretionary spending related retail, like workouts. We're going to continue to see tech, and we're going to continue to see travel. It's been the past couple of years, and I don't see that slowing down going into 26. And I think all the types of activity that we've been dealing with are going to continue into next year. We're going to be dealing with a lot of LMEs, or step two LMEs, if you will, and we're going to be dealing with M&A transactions and trying to figure out how to save situations that otherwise should end up in Chapter 11.
Do you see any activity? Tyler mentioned it briefly. He said episodic situations regarding AI companies that are under pressure because of AI disruption.
I mean, they have to at some point. Everybody's trying to figure out what's going to happen to their companies because of the advent of AI, hopefully good and very little bad. We're all figuring out how to take advantage of the technology. But what we are seeing is specifically with the software companies, there are layoffs, significant layoffs. And so what is that going to mean? Are those companies going to need restructuring or workout advice? We don't know, but Tyler and I are trying to figure that out.
For sure. We're in a couple of situations, early days, a call center business, for example. Do you really need that type of business, or can you cut your workforce by 80, 90%? Have you invested in the technology to replace that with AI, or is just one of your competitors going to eat you alive? It all goes to how proactive you've been to invest in this stuff. So, and it's a key theme that when we talk to our creditor clients in their underwrites now, whether it's a private credit issuance or when they're thinking about a trading position in a loan or a bond, like they're all going through and asking themselves, okay, what's the AI risk here? Is there AI risk? How should that be baked into my investment thesis as to whether I'm going to buy more or sell? That's a key theme. And I think that will absolutely continue going forward because investment committees are really asking that question.
Now, this is for you, Tyler, because I can't have you on the podcast before we wrap up and not ask you a question about the bankrupt auto parts company First Brands. And Jamie, you can talk about it too. Everybody has an opinion about this. For our listeners who don't know about it, this is one of the fastest free falls into Chapter 11 we've seen in recent years. It's a classic story of red flags being ignored. We have alleged fraud involving factoring and receivables around $2 billion that has vanished and can't be accounted for. That Wire has a specific podcast dedicated to this topic, so please listen to it. I know you can't say too much, Tyler, about this case since Lazard is representing the company, but given your over two decades of experience, restructuring experience, I wanted you to talk about the implications of this case for our current market and also how does First Brands differentiate itself from other Chapter 11 cases.
Big picture, it's a remarkable story in the sense that how can such a large company raise upwards of $12 billion of capital from highly sophisticated institutions and not have somebody raise their hand or more people raise their hand, articulate that their issues. And it really raises questions about these institutions' kind of diligence practices. It raises questions about the auditing and whatnot. And there's still a lot to learn on this one. We're unpacking the pieces day in and day out. But I definitely think that there needs to be a lot of self-reflection amongst the lending community as to how did we let this happen? And don't take things for granted when you're getting 20% plus returns on invoice factoring. Maybe there's something there, because is that really the type of compensation you should be getting for buying an invoice from a Walmart or a Costco who's an investment grade company? So it just raises a lot of questions. Now, do I think there's like a systemic issue in the private credit world? No, not at all. I think it just goes to certain institutions have been a little bit too aggressive and not done the underwriting that they should have done in these situations. And people need to just pull back and really think hard about their investment processes and diligence processes to make sure this doesn't happen again.
The only thing that I would add is it's a great example of the fact that, thank God, we still have a Chapter 11 process. And you need to have a court system and a bankruptcy code and bankruptcy rules to handle situations like this, notwithstanding all of the efforts that Tyler and I and our groups and many others like us every day are trying to do things out of court with. Sometimes companies just need something greater than professionals, and that's what the bankruptcy system is for.
And I think, Tyler, compared to other cases that involve fraud in Chapter 11, like Enron or Delphi, this company, I think, got into Chapter 11 with a business that was pretty much eroded. And
the business is certainly pretty sick in the sense that it was under a lot of pressure. And I think we had no time, essentially, to really figure out what was going on. We had basically 2 weeks from when we learned about some of these issues to when we filed for Chapter 11, which is very different than these other situations. And so raising a $1.1 billion dip from creditors when you're effectively telling them that there are really large kind of irregularities in certain aspects of their business is certainly the most challenging capital raise I've ever had to do. And one where, you know, we didn't know whether we'd be successful at the end of the day, because there was certainly a perspective of some in that group where, you know, in their words, if there's fraud over here, how do we know that it's not here and here as well? Is there really a business here? How do I get confidence in that? And that's just something that is they took a leap of faith and will remain to be seen how it's going to play out in the end.
I also wanted to ask you briefly about the private credit market, because you said it's not an indication that there's a widespread sickness in the private credit market. There are maybe some cockroaches, not that many. So this market hasn't really been faced with a systemic crisis like the great financial crisis. And Jamie represents a lot of creditors in this market too. How confident are you in its resilience when hit with a true market dislocation?
I believe that the credit market is going to continue to be as active as we've seen it over the past couple of years. I don't know if we're going to have a true dislocation. You know, Tyler can speak to that, but we continue to see more activity than ever year over year. And I think that private credit lenders are figuring out how to work out situations when necessary. And obviously, sometimes they're going to need a bankruptcy court process to save a certain situation. But I think that the resilience is going to be everything that we would expect over the past few years that we've seen.
Yeah, the only thing I would add is that I think there's a big focus on a lot of these institutions in developing kind of the restructuring and workout muscle. And I think if we have 3 to 5 years before there's like a big restructuring cycle, think like 5% default rates, I think they'll be fine because they have time to really build that skill set and muscle. And frankly, it requires hiring a lot of people given the number of companies in these large asset managers or private credit managers portfolios. But I think if there is a bigger kind of restructuring event in the next year, for example, I think a lot of these institutions will struggle just from a practical perspective
because there's just so many situations they need to manage and not enough people within their institutions to deal with it.
You know, the one of the biggest changes that we've seen is, especially within our global credit and global finance team, we're thinking through with them from a very early inception what happens down the line. Like, they historically had always tried to troubleshoot the worst case scenarios for our clients. But given the fact that we could see Chapter 11s, given the fact that we are seeing more private credit workouts and LMEs right now, we're just putting that much more time and effort into making sure not only that we educate our clients, but that we're working through in the credit documents from a leakage, from a capacity, but also just from a here's how certain LMEs may play out, thinking through a year and a half ahead of time, because the private credit clients that we have want to make sure that they're prepared if this does ultimately come to bear.
Jamie, Tyler, any final thoughts or key takeaways you'd like to leave our listeners with before we wrap up?
First of all, thank you so much for having me. Really excited to do this. I would say 26 is probably going to be just as active, if not more active, in a number of respects than we had in 25, which was a hallmark year for many of us. There are so many creative professionals out there who are constantly trying to peel the apple in a different way. But the intersection of finance and restructuring is something that we are incredibly excited about, focused on. We are continuing to try to grow out our finance team within the restructuring group as much as we can. And it's been a tremendous change as we started this podcast, noticing what the Chapter 11 world used to be to the out-of-court restructuring world that we have right now. It seems like anything that we do involves finance, and that's going to continue over the next year. Really excited to be part of a large group across the U.S. and Europe, and really excited to see what happens in Europe over the next couple of years as well.
Thanks for having us. I'm very optimistic about 26 as well, but selfishly, I'm also looking forward to a vacation at some point. It's been a busy 2025, so thank you.
Thank you.
With that, we'll bring today's discussion to a close. Thank you for your insights. Thank you to our listeners as well for tuning into this episode of That Wired. As always, you can subscribe to or download every episode on Apple and find thousands of articles with insights, research, and more from our That team at thatwired.com.